Thank you very much, Neil. Thank you for this great chance to present my recent work at this seminar. So yeah, I will be talking about gravitational wave props of cosmology. So as you see, I've chosen a very broad title, which means I've been talking about several adjacent topics, which also means that probably I will not be able to go into very much technical details, but I will be very happy if you ask questions about those technical technical details. I will be happy to discuss and answer any questions you will have. So the idea of today's talk is to see how we can use gravitational waves to probe the standard model of cosmology. So let me start with a very quick lightning summary of the standard model itself. So we believe that at very early times, universe underwent an inflationary expansion, which on top of solving several problems of hot Big Bang, standard FLRW cosmology, it also generated fluctuations, which we think source to the CMB anisotropies and the large-scale structure of the universe that we see today. So the simplest working scenario is a single dynamical scalar field with a flat enough potential. And this scalar field generates all those quantum fluctuations that I mentioned earlier. So one prediction of the standard scenario is that we have almost scale invariant curvature power spectrum, which Planck satellite has measured with a very good accuracy. So here we see this almost scale invariant spectrum, which can be parameterized in this simple power law form. So on top of the scalar perturbations, which source the large scale structure and CMB anisotropies, inflationary models also predict gravitational waves. So since today's theme is gravitational waves, I should introduce this as well. In analogy to the scalar power spectrum, there is also tensor power spectrum generated during inflation. Finding those primordial gravitational waves produced during inflation is very important, is a big deal, because it will tell us about the detailed physical, we think it will tell us about physical details of inflation. Particularly, there is this quantity, tensor to scalar ratio, which Planck satellite has imposed upper bounds. So this blue contour is one sigma contour of Planck satellite, and it has put an upper bound on this quantity. And this quantity is related to a couple of important properties of the inflationary models. Particularly, it is related to how much the inflaton field travels during inflation. So if this R is measured to be large, then the inflaton field is supposed to be traveling over large super Planckian distances during inflation. So if this R, so related to this, this tensor to scalar ratio is also related to the energy scale of inflation. Upcoming probes like LIGHTBIRD, which is led by Japanese JAXA, is supposed to improve the constraints on this tensor to scalar ratio and bring it down to the level of 10 to minus 3. And if the primordial gravitational waves are at this level, then LIGHTBIRD will be able to measure those. So this was about the early universe of our standard picture of the universe. For the late universe, we believe that it is governed by a simple model called lambda CDM, which assumes general relativity and assumes the presence of a cosmological constant which accelerates the expansion of the universe. So even though this model is very well tested, there is still a very large wiggle room for interesting alternatives. For example, one common way to consider as an alternative to this lambda CDM scenario is to consider modified background expansion histories of the universe, which is one simple extension is given by this W naught WA extension, which tells that the equation of state of dark energy is not constant, as in the cosmological constant scenario, but is some time varying function parameterized by two constants. There can also be some extra degrees of freedom. For example, there can be fifth forces, which are coupled, which basically act as extra gravity on cosmological scales. And due to those, we might see some alterations in the clustering history of the universe. So again, future surveys in this part. So there are many surveys ongoing and upcoming, which will measure this paradigm in late universe. So here I just for concreteness show some forecast results from Euclid collaboration, which show that all those quantities will be measured with pretty good accuracy in upcoming years. So the standard picture is great. However, so we can think of modifying it just because of theoretical curiosity. As I said, there is a big wiggle room, but also there are some tensions, most notorious of them being the Hubble tension, which says that the determination, when we determine the Hubble expansion rate of the universe with early universe probes, we get a lower value, we infer a lower value of the expansion rate of the universe than when we use basically direct or low redshift local probes for the expansion. So this naturally brings us to the topic of today's talk, which is gravitational waves. And the way the link is basically in this last couple of points. So basically, as I will be explaining shortly, gravitational waves can be used to independently measure the expansion rate of universe and in general other properties of cosmological scenario. And even though the uncertainties at the moment are large, in upcoming years we will see a huge improvement in accuracy for the use of gravitational waves for cosmological inference. So in the last 5 or so years, we have gathered a lot of gravitational wave detections. So this is kind of the current landscape of all the direct detections, all the direct astrophysical detections. As you see, most of them are coming from black hole binaries. So the blue points are black hole binaries. There has been also a detection of binary neutron star merger, and also very recently a merger of neutron star and a black hole. So the natural question is that, so we are interested in cosmology and how we can use those astrophysical gravitational wave detections. So how those can be used to test various properties of the cosmological scenario. In general, in order to use a given observable in cosmology, the way it works is that typically we measure some distances and we know the redshift of the source to we know a redshift to a particular source, and then the given cosmological distance depends on various cosmological parameters and cosmological models. So putting the redshift and the distance measurements together, we can basically construct some, for example, luminosity distance redshift diagram and test our models. Gravitational waves work a bit differently. So it turns out we cannot directly infer. So there is a redshift mass degeneracy for gravitational wave sources. So we cannot really measure directly the redshift of gravitational wave source directly. But what we can measure in principle, in theory, are two polarizations of gravitational waves, these so-called cross and plus polarizations, which depend on various things, which I will quickly summarize now. So one thing is the source properties. For example, the combination of the source masses, like we have some binary, they have some masses, and they form this quantity, which is called a chirp mass. And as we see, this chirp mass determines the observable strain that arrives at our gravitational wave detectors. So this chirp mass can be measured due to the frequency, the time evolution of the frequency of the given gravitational wave event. So we can say that this chirp mass is measured with high accuracy. Then what is left in here, there are two crucial quantities, which is this angle, which is the inclination angle of the orbit of gravitational wave binary, and most importantly for us, this luminosity distance to the gravitational wave source. So basically, gravitational wave detections can help us to measure the luminosity distance to the given source. So we will not know the redshift to the source, but we can at least measure the luminosity distance. So basically, we will have at least half of the picture from gravitational wave detections only. So as I mentioned, there is this other quantity, which is the inclination angle, which is basically, so there is a degeneracy between those two quantities. And that's a separate topic, how to break this degeneracy. For example, if you use many detectors, you can measure those two polarizations separately. And then, as you see, those two polarizations depend on the angle in different ways. So we can use, we can combine those in order to cancel the dependence on inclination angle and then measure separately the luminosity distance. But for our purposes in this talk, we will assume that the luminosity distance to a gravitational wave source is known with certain accuracy. So we have our gravitational wave source. We can the question is how to use it for cosmological purposes. And the first kind of idea came all the way back, like from Schultz in 1980s, and the suggestion is that for some of the sources, for example, if you have instead of binary black holes, you have binary neutron stars, you might expect also some electromagnetic counterpart, which you can use to pinpoint the galaxy where the given binary is residing. And then you can measure the redshift to the given source. And then as soon as you have the redshift, you can basically, you have the luminosity distance and you have the redshift, then you can use this to constrain various cosmological parameters, for example, the expansion rate of the universe. So this has been applied in the past, not only for the Hubble rate measurement, but also for other cosmological parameters. For example, in this figure, shown that gravitational waves with electromagnetic counterparts, in this particular case, gravitational wave sources with short GRBs associated with them, can be used to impose constraints on equation of state of dark energy and omega matter, and also in principle of Hubble rate and other relevant parameters. So in the future, this is just to give you some timeline. What are we going to expect? How many sources and what kind of measurements we should be expecting. So this is a neat timeline of expected gravitational wave observations. So here are different detectors, starting from LIGO, including LIGO Virgo, and so on and so forth. And basically, the culmination is this third generation column here, which is Einstein Telescope, and possibly Einstein Telescope type network of Einstein Telescope type detectors. So as we go into this era of third generation detectors, we will start exploring very deep sources. So we'll enter basically cosmological distances, and we will also be able to pinpoint the gravitational wave sources very accurately on the sky. So this percentage is that above 60% of all the observed sources will be able to locate within 20 degrees square on the sky. And on this other line, we see the gradual increase in the expected number of, in this case, binary neutron star detections. And we see that this third generation will already see thousands, or if not hundreds of thousands, sources. So this is basically telling us that we can already kind of start doing some useful cosmology at this third generation stage. So after this this quick summary, let me tell you what I will be talking about more concretely in this talk. So in this first part, basically I was telling you that in order, so the standard way to use gravitational wave sources for cosmology is to try to combine them with electromagnetic counterparts. And in this first part, I will be asking the question, is this really necessary? So in other words, can we use gravitational wave sources without electromagnetic counterparts for cosmological purposes? And the answer will be yes. Particularly, I will tell you how to use redshift unknown gravitational wave sources for testing gravitational wave propagation in the late universe. In the second part, related to the first one, I will be talking about so-called stochastic gravitational wave background and anisotropies on this stochastic gravitational wave background originating from astrophysical sources. And I will be telling what this background is good for, what this background is useful for. In the third part, I will move into basically non-standard model part of the story. So I will be talking about the origin of those observed black holes. So I was telling we have already observed many black holes, but what is the origin of those black holes? And I will particularly concentrate on the possibility of at least part of them being of primordial origin and not a result of the endpoint of stellar collapse. So I don't know if I will have much time for this fourth part, but if I will have time, I will quickly summarize some recent results about primordial gravitational waves and what they imply about the models of inflationary universe. So here is papers which those results are derived in. So let's get started with the first part. So the idea of this part is to, as I was saying, is to use gravitational wave events without electromagnetic counterparts. So basically, if you have two black hole mergers, you don't, the current understanding is that you don't expect any electromagnetic counterpart associated with such an event. So how can those sources be used for cosmological studies? And the idea is to use the clustering properties of those gravitational wave sources instead of knowing their exact redshift. So we have our gravitational wave sources, and similar to galaxies, those sources are expected to be clustered, inhomogeneously clustered in space. And as a result, if we consider something similar to the number count of galaxies on the sky, we can expect some number count map on the sky. Now, if you have, as I was saying, for those sources, we only know their luminosity distance. So let's say we take some sources with certain luminosity distance, and we can measure basically their clustering on the sky, how the number count is clustered on the sky. Then if we cross-correlate this pattern of overdensities of those gravitational wave sources on the sky with that of galaxy overdensities at various redshifts, we will see that at certain redshift, those two patterns of gravitational wave maps and of galaxy maps, basically they match very well. So in this particular case, those red dots are, so this is some nice demonstration taken from this paper. So basically, the red dots are some simulated or painted gravitational wave sources on top of n-body simulation. And the blue ones are galaxies. So those red, the gravitational wave binaries are injected at this redshift, at this particular redshift. Then if we, so basically the red distribution is the same in all those three panels, but the galaxy distributions are at different redshifts. So they are different. So if we consider the correlation function of those maps, we will see that at low redshifts, the correlation is essentially zero. So there is no correlation between those two maps here. And there is no correlation at higher redshifts, but this cross correlation is maximum at the correct redshift. So basically, even if we don't have the redshift of individual gravitational wave sources, we still can infer the redshift of those sources in a statistical way using the clustering properties of those sources and using the cross correlation with galaxy catalogs. So this is the idea. And what is this idea exactly useful for? So we can there are some works which have shown that you can use this to constrain cosmological parameters, which is great. But in this talk, I will concentrate on something else, which is about modified propagation law of gravitational waves. So here I am showing you a general propagation of gravitational tensor modes on cosmological backgrounds. General relativity is particularly simple. So this function is zero in general relativity. This function is one. So this alpha t function basically is zero, and the mass of gravitons is zero. On top of that, if we don't have any anisotropic form of matter, then this right-hand side is also zero. So in some extensions of general relativity, as I was mentioning, there are some models where there is some extrascalar field which is coupled to matter, so-called scalar tensor theories, for example. Those functions start to deviate from zero, and they can imprint some interesting properties on top of the standard propagation law of gravitational waves. So this tensor, the mass of tensor modes for cosmological purposes is constrained to be very small. So we will not be considering this. So if we want those theories to be relevant on cosmological scales, this mass scale is typically the scale of dark energy, so it's tiny. There is this interesting modification of the speed of propagation of gravitational waves, which is, we now know that this is constrained to be extremely close to the speed of light. So this is also not an open possibility anymore, but there is one interesting open possibility still remaining, which is this extra term on top of the standard Hubble friction. So in GR, again, this is zero. So we have the standard friction term, but in several interesting modifications of general relativity, we have this extra damping of gravitational waves. And the question is how.
Valerie, can I ask something? So in these models that you were describing, are these alphas meant to be taken as frequency dependent, or are they frequency independent?
Yeah. So those are only functions of time. So. So the frequency dependence maybe could come if they could be functions of scale, but so those are only functions of time. So they only evolve over redshift, and gravitational waves of all the frequencies basically experience the same function. It's universal for all the frequencies.
So the shape of like the waveform from some inspiraling binary won't be changed. Just the amplitude will be changed in this picture.
Yeah, so at least in case of this of those modifications that I'm showing here, that's true. So the shape will not be changing. But I guess there are maybe some cases where this this overall dispersion relation of gravitational waves is modified in more non-trivial ways, maybe in frequency-dependent way. I guess that could be a possibility. I don't know if people how much they have looked into it, but in standard kind of this, the most considered scalar tensor theories, the modification is coming through those time-dependent functions only.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you. Right, so as I said, I will not be considering some anisotropic matter. I will not be considering any massive gravitons, and all the gravitons will be traveling with speed of light. What we are left with is only this this damping term, which I will be considering. And just to give you some idea, where does this damping term, extra damping term, coming from? So it's basically here I'm showing an action of a modification of gravity. So we have the Einstein-Hilbert term of general relativity. But in this case, typically we would have the Planck scale here. So we would have m Planck squared. But in this case, we have, instead of this constant gravitational coupling, we have a dynamical gravitational coupling. So basically this is promoted to some dynamical coupling, m effective squared. And it turns out that when we work out the propagation of tensor modes in such a theory, these translates into extra friction term for gravitational waves on cosmological backgrounds. So basically this alpha m is related to running of gravitational coupling in those theories. So interestingly, when we have such a theory, not only gravitational wave propagation is modified, but also the way the structure is clustered is also modified, and things like weak lensing, for example, is also modified. So this first equation is a schematic form of the Poisson equation, which in general relativity, this thing would be one, but in this case, it's time and scale dependent function. And this is the Lenzing equation for Lenzing potential. And again, there is this sigma, which is in principle should be one in general relativity, but it's a function of time and scale. And it turns out that when we combine those functions in this form, so it has been shown that when this quantity eta is non-unity, that means that either this alpha t function or this alpha m function should be non-zero. Since we already set this to zero, what we are left with is this non-zero alpha m. So basically there is this complementary effect of this running Planck, running gravitational coupling, both on the propagation of gravitational waves and on weak lensing and galaxy and basically clustering of matter. So, okay, how?
So, 1 second. As Luis raised his hand for a question. So you want to go ahead, Luis?
Yeah, thank you. Hey, Valerie, so you made a connection between alpha and the effective dynamical factor in front of the Ricci scalar. There is no influence of the G3 term, or is it because you're assuming these are perturbation of an FLRW background or something like that?
Yeah, I guess indeed this is for FRW. On other backgrounds, there might be some, I forgot from which term, but yeah, if you don't have FRW background, but for example, some spherically symmetric, spheric propagation on some spherically symmetric background, then I think, yeah, there can be some effects from those other functions as well. But it's not only this coupling, but on FRW, the effect is only basically it's one-to-one. Basically the time variation of this is, it translates into alpha n.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, thanks for the question. So we have this thing, and how this can be tested. This is the propagation law of gravitational waves. In order to connected to something more observable, Well, in a sense, it's clear that since this is a like extra damping, extra attenuation of gravitational waves, then probably what it would mean is that gravitational wave source would look dimmer in those theories than they would look in GR. So the effect is that, as a result, this motivates to introduce some quantity, which is quoted as gravitational wave luminosity distance in the literature. So this subscript gravitational wave is here to remind us that basically we have our standard FRW luminosity distance, basically inferred from electromagnetic observations or how light travels on FRW spacetime. But on top of that, there is, in addition to this, there is this other quantity, which is the luminosity distance of gravitational waves, which is, in general, this ratio is not unity in such theories. Particularly, this ratio is given by such an integrated form of this alpha m function. So in the literature, typically this has been considered in a parameterized form, which is motivated by some parameterized forms of those alpha n functions. So this parameterized form is given by two constant quantities, this chi zero and n, and basically this fully determines the redshift evolution of this ratio. So how, again, going back to this idea of using redshift unknown gravitational wave sources to test this propagation law. Let me, so in this slide, quickly summarize how the method is working in a technical level. So we have some distribution of gravitational wave sources, which is given by some window function. So those gravitational wave sources trace the underlying dark matter distribution. So we can, for example, assume some simple linear bias of overdensities of gravitational wave source number counts and underlying dark matter. So this is basically very similar to what we typically do for galaxy clustering, right? So again, for galaxy clustering, there is some linear bias, and there is some window function which dictates the redshift distribution.
Larry. So hey, for the window function, how are you taking into account the selection effects for gravitational sources?
Yeah, so we are following an earlier work by, so I will mention this, but yeah, so we are basically following an earlier work by Oguri, Masmune Oguri, from 2016, I think. So it is basically some functional form. So this quantity has various effects in it. One is the how the sources are populated over the redshift. So that's one thing which enters here. Another thing is as I guess you are mentioning, is basically the selection function in the luminosity distance space. Then you basically introduce some top hat in luminosity distance space, which translates into some other, basically you specify this in luminosity distance space, but then in this case, it's integral over redshift. So when you translate it back into redshift, then you have some dependence of those.
Because these functions, I assume, are going to have a mass dependence, because the gravitational sources are going to have a mass dependence as well through the selection function.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's true. So in principle, yeah, there will be some mass dependence here as well. Yeah. So basically, like very far away sources will not be. For example, very far away sources will not be detected, or very light sources will have very very low signal to noise, so they will also not be detected. But in this case, yeah. So it is kind of like some simple fitting description that we are following, which can be improved in, when the real data comes, it can be improved. And basically everything boils down to putting some, the good thing of this method is that you can put whatever basically redshift distribution function you want, and the modeling of the redshift distribution is a separate step. You see what I mean?
Okay. Thanks.
In this case, we follow some prescription from Oguri, which is I guess yeah. So it's in reality more realistic. Basically, window functions should be used. Yeah. So basically,
one more question. In your expressions for these two-point functions, you're only showing the two halo terms. It looks like. Is there a reason why you drop the one halo pieces?
For larger scales. So we never consider very very small scale clustering effects here.
So there's no sources for which you can anticipate having small localization errors.
Yeah, in principle, those things can be taken into account. But since the localization errors that we have in mind are very large, so we concentrate on the angular sensitivity that we expect is of order 10 square degrees or so. So we will never be able to measure very large multiple ranges, right? So. So basically what we have here is only very, very large scale correlations.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. That is me. Yeah. Thank you. Maybe
sorry for interrupting you. I have a related question on what Neil has asked. Mm-hmm. So basically when you come to, if you're showing for the 3G detectors, your localization is going to improve a lot. It depends again on the masses of the gravitational resources. So if I have a source which I set low redshift, you can pick up a lot of information also from larger, as Neil was mentioning about higher one halo term can play a role there. I mean, if you're only focusing on LIGO resources, I can agree. But for ET and CE, things will get different.
I guess so we had a short discussion about it, but we didn't very carefully look into that. That's a good point. I think for ET still, the localization error is not very, very good, right? It's not drastically that different from LIGO. So my guess is that still those small scale clustering effects should not be very relevant. But I guess one should more carefully look into that. If I may go forward, I'm running a bit late on time. We have those autocorrelation functions, and then we can consider the cross correlation of those two models. And then the idea is that we have this ratio, which with this parametrization in this case. Imagine basically, we don't have the real data. So what we did is to generate some mock sources. And imagine those mock sources are generated as if the universe would be following GR. So basically this chi naught would be unity. Then let's look at this cross correlation signal. And let's consider the correlation with redshift, with galaxies at different redshifts. So when we cross-correlate with galaxies at different redshifts, again, we observe that this cross-correlation signal peaks at the correct redshift. So with this method, we can pick up the correct redshift. And on top of that, if we try to fit the given cross-correlation, observed cross-correlation with a different value of chi naught, we will see that it will actually be peaking at a different redshift. So all those cross-correlations are pretty different from one another. So we can use this method to measure this quantity chi naught, or to measure basically this modified evolution of gravitational waves. One particular thing we did in this paper, so this parametrization is great to have this parametrization, but as I was saying, it is just one generic choice, which does not necessarily connect to real physical parametrization. So it's better to be more general. And in this particular work, what we did is to try to reconstruct the redshift evolution of this ratio. So we used a method called Gaussian process regression. So in short, like in intuitive sense, Gaussian process regression is, so in cosmology we are used to, so when we have some PDF, we do some parameter estimation. So we basically draw some points from a given PDF, and then we infer the entire PDF. But there is a method, so this Gaussian process reconstruction allows us to pick functions from field curves from space of functions instead of points from like two-dimensional or n-dimensional space. So this basically allows us to sample various functional forms. So in this particular case, so there are all those dotted ones are different samples that you can draw. And then using this method, we can reconstruct. Again, we don't have the data, so we have some fiducial model. And the goal is to reconstruct the functional form of those fiducial model. So this right-hand figure basically shows our reconstruction. So this blue line is our fiducial, which we are trying to reconstruct. And the black shaded area is the reconstructed contours with this method. So the bottom line is that even if the fiducial model is much different from GR, so GR would have been this flat line here, even if it has this curvature here, this method allows to reconstruct this form. And then for reference, those different dashed lines are different basically, different forms of this ratio. So basically the bottom line is that with this method, we could model in a model independent way, we could rule out those different possibilities. Okay, so one thing before I move to the next topic. So there are three main things which we can vary in basically when choosing our experimental configuration. There are three main parameters which control the experimental sensitivities. Those are the angular sensitivity. So as we were talking a bit earlier, so basically the localization errors, which translates into some maximum multiple that can be measured on the sky. The other essential piece is the number of gravitational wave sources. And finally, the third piece is the error on the uncertainty with which we can measure the luminosity distance of the sources. So here on this axis, it's the expected constraints, expected percentage constraints on this quantity chi naught, for example. And for the on the horizontal axis is the signal to noise ratio of the data, basically the signal, like the angular power spectrum signal divided by the corresponding variance. And then we see how the errors, how the expected constraints scale with signal to noise ratio. So by changing those quantities, we can change the signal to noise ratio. And one interesting thing we observe is that as soon as we establish a given signal to noise ratio, let's say this given signal to noise ratio of 15, it does not matter if we reach this by increasing the number of sources or increasing the angular sensitivity of the detector. So as soon as a given signal to noise ratio is established, it does not matter for the determination of this quantity. However, this uncertainty, so this measurement, the precision with which we can measure this parameter depends very drastically on how well we can estimate the luminosity, we can measure the luminosity distances of gravitational wave sources. So as we see, this line is much steeper than the other ones. So this kind of advocates that it is much more important to have better luminosity distance measurements, reduced luminosity distance measurement errors, than, for example, trying to increase the angular sensitivity of the detector.
So how do you propagate the error in the H naught for these predictions?
So we did the full MCMC inference. So in this particular case, we basically used, our goal was not to measure cosmological parameters. So our kind of logic was that cosmological parameters are known from some other probes. And in this particular case, we used Planck priors on H naught, omega m, and the rest of cosmological parameters. So we have Planck priors, and then we have our likelihood, which we fully sample with Monte Carlo methods.
Because I am asking this because xi naught and h naught are going to have highly degenerate. So your error bars are going to a bit more if you allow, because object Absolutely. Can be nearby Absolutely. Or far also by just changing h naught. So mm-hmm. that will play a role in your error bars. And then n, I think, will change. Importance of n will be shown there as well.
Exactly. So if we, that's a good point. So if you want to have like fully self, basically, if you want to infer everything from this method, So this figure, I can easily imagine that those scalings can change. So this n can also have a very steep scaling. But in this case, our logic was that cosmological parameters are going to be measured from like CMB very precisely. They are already measured very precisely, and we used Planck priors on them basically. So essentially they don't play a role at all.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you again. Let me very quickly go through this second part, which is about stochastic gravitational wave background from astrophysical sources. So far I was talking about number counts of resolved gravitational wave sources. However, on top of that, so not all the sources will be measured. Some of them will be below the detection threshold, especially if there are sources, especially the sources above the detection horizon, none of them will be resolved. So all those sources, we expect that they will contribute to the so-called gravitational wave background, which in this panel, I'm showing basically the expected sensitivity curves and the expected signals from binary black hole and binary neutron star populations. So this is basically the homogeneous piece, so basically angularly averaged piece of this background. This is basically interesting. Cosmologists are are looking at this signal in multiple frequency bands, like in LIGO band, I showed this. So in LISA band, there is some interesting signal coming from second order gravitational waves. So however, even in LISA band, the astrophysical sources are expected to contribute at the times of their in spiral. So much earlier, before they're actually enter the final stages of their coalescence. So the bottom line is that those astrophysical sources contribute to the background, and also some other sources contribute to this background, and it's important to disentangle those different effects, like effects coming from the induced gravitational waves, from the effect coming from astrophysical sources. And in order to do this, the astrophysical contribution should be carefully modeled. So the monopole piece is discussed a lot in the literature. However, similar to the number counts, is also expected to be anisotropic on sky. So there is one expects to have not only the angularly averaged contribution, which can be measured, but one can also hope to measure the relative anisotropies of intensity of gravitational waves on the sky. So in this work, we aimed to model this signal and see what can be extracted from this. So this map on the sky is we model simply as some line of sight integral where we have the gravitational wave over densities together with some, again, linear bias term. We have the distribution of gravitational wave sources across redshift. And then there is this astrophysical kernel function which encodes the luminosity of sources seen in gravitational waves as a function of redshift. So basically this is the average contribution to the background from a given redshift. So again, we can form some power spectra. So we can consider the autocorrelation power spectra, and we can again consider cross correlations with galaxy clustering. So in this work, we show actually that autocorrelation power spectrum has some, so it's more difficult to model it because it depends on nonlinear scales, while the cross correlation depends much less. And this is kind of, again, advocating to look for cross correlations instead of for autocorrelations. And again, we did, we did some statistics with this, trying to see what can be measured. So in this figure on horizontal axis, I'm showing the angular sensitivity with which those anisotropies might be observed. And the different points are different properties of this astrophysical kernel that I was showing. So this is the overall amplitude, and this Z star is some cutoff redshift above which the sources do not contribute anymore. Like there are not enough sources, for example. So this basically captures the truncation redshift of star formation rate as one thing. So we see that depending on angular sensitivity, like if we have decent angular sensitivity of let's say L max of 50, then we can measure those quantities with, for example, this Z star at the level of 10%, for example. So Wadip, do you have a question?
Yeah, so here he is talking about LMAX. These are the LMAX for the cross-correlation between the stochastic gravitational background and galaxy surface, right?
And galaxy surface, yeah, exactly.
So, how are you going up to LMAX beyond 4 with the stochastic? Because what overlap reduction function do you consider?
Yeah, so... that's another good point, that this LMAX for stochastic sources. So this 100 is could be considered as a stretch. So that's why we consider all this swath of
L's. One cannot go beyond four up to Uther Dixon SNR because you measure up to a 1 radian typically, 3 to 4 L max. You cannot, because you cross correlate between two detectors, so you have to take into account the overlap reduction function.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So for which experiments do you do that? I mean, what is the overlap reduction function?
So the overlap reduction function is not taken into account in this analysis. So all the errors are cosmological cosmic variance errors. So basically the instrumental uncertainties are not considered.
Oh, because overlap reduction function will completely kill anything at high frequency, which you need to resolve the small scales. So you do not go anything beyond 1 radian.
Yeah, so indeed. So any detector which is planned, so it will, so I admittedly, this will not be very practical for any of the detectors which are planned. So this is in a sense more like a theoretical forecast, taking into account only cosmic variance errors. So any detector uncertainties are not taken into account in this analysis. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But yeah, so basically for cross correlations, the instrumental noise is not, I'm not aware of any work which considers the instrumental noise for cross correlation. So what you were saying has been done for autocorrelation studies, and indeed it completely kills anything above L max of 4.
So there is no autocorrelation in the cross correlation itself is the problem, mm-hmm. because you do not resolve small scales in stochastic gravitational wave background, because when you cross correlate two detectors of gravitational wave, the wavelength doesn't overlap between two detectors. So you don't resolve very well the spatial resolution of stochastic gravitational wave background maps. So you have a resolution of 1 radian. So you cross correlate that with a galaxy survey, you basically wash out anything at beyond that small scale. So you are limited by L of 3 to 4. So it's 180 degree divided by about 60. So it's L of 3 to 4. That's what remains with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So also,
if you have more detectors, wouldn't that address that problem if you correlate multiple detectors with each other?
Is it for me? Unfortunately, no, actually.
I think it's a bit sort of a dip, yeah, because I mean, you're going to have more. Because I mean, the point is that if you have more detectors, you could localize things better.
That is true for the individual sources, but not for the background, because.
I don't see the difference between the two. I mean, I think the principle is the same.
So I know, like, people are considering, are studying like this map making for stochastic background, and they definitely do not look only for L of 4, right? So probably like LIGO Virgo will not see anything beyond L of 4. That's
no, they do. I mean, Contaldi and all, I mean, the people who are making maps, they take into account overlap reduction function, and they are aware of this problem.
Papers
of this group, they have done it properly. Yeah, they have taken
into account. But they don't only. Yeah. So is there a conclusion that basically nothing will observe above L of 4? I mean, I'm a bit doubtful about
for two detectors. That's right. Even with Einstein telescope, you can slightly push ahead because of the three detector kind of structure.
So for Einstein telescope, the number that I find in the literature is of L max of 10. So this is a typical kind of ballpark that is typically quoted. But anyways, yeah. So this is, I guess. I guess. So it depends a lot on detector configurations and things. So in this case, again, I repeat that this is a theoretical cosmic variance limited analysis, which is a stretch in a sense that if you take into account overlap reduction function of detectors, then probably you don't have chance of making very detailed maps of gravitational waves. Anyway, so That's one problem that Suvadip pointed out. So this observable turns out to have other problems as well, which is one of them being the shot noise. And it turns out that so on top of there is the standard kind of discreteness shot noise. But for example, in LIGO bound, the events are also discrete in time, as a result of which you have some time series shot noise term, which is given by this term, which is completely dominant over the signal in LIGO case. So in LIGO frequency band, where the duration of sources is very short compared to the observation timescales, this temporal component of the shot noise completely dominates over the signal. However, in LISA band, where the in-spiral stage is very, very long compared to observation time, this can be overcome. So Neil, can I have like 5-6 minutes to quickly wrap up this this additional section? Do I have like 5 minutes or?
We are getting over time. Well, okay, like, well, people have to go, you know, they can go. So yeah, so go ahead, yeah, you know, a few more minutes.
Sure, yeah, a few more minutes very very quickly. So so in this part, I will be talking about primordial black holes. So basically, I was talking about those astrophysical black hole observations. And now the question is, what is the origin of those black holes? And there is this scenario that they might be forming from high density peaks on small scales. And how the binaries are formed in such a scenario. So basically in early universe, like in a radiation dominated universe, when two black holes are decoupled from Hubble flow and they fall on top of each other, there is a third black hole, which can torque this slightly. And then you can form a very eccentric binary. The second scenario is that in dark matter halos, when two primordial black holes approach each other, they will, if the impact parameter is small enough, then there will be some gravitational wave emission and you will form black hole binaries. And for both of the scenarios, the event rates are estimated and the claim is that they can basically explain the observed rates. So as I was telling in my introduction, there is also, so recently there have been observations of black hole neutron star mergers to events. And the question is, so black hole mergers seems can be explained with primordial black holes. Can black hole neutron star mergers be explained with similar? So basically, can the black hole counterpart in black hole neutron star events be of primordial origin? So in this case, because neutron stars are already in galaxies, the formation channel is this second channel. Basically in halos, they approach each other, there is some gravitational wave emission, and then the binary forms. So our summary is on this right figure where we show the rate, so merger rate. So this red line is for binary black hole mergers, and the black line is for binary neutron star mergers, and dotted and dashed lines are for different FPBH parameter, which controls how much primordial black holes there are. So I'm sorry, I should connect my laptop, otherwise it will die. Apologies for that. Yeah, So let's concentrate on FPBH of one, which is the case when all the dark matter is in primordial. So basically, all dark matter, those primordial black holes can act as dark matter, and FPBH of one means that all the dark matter in the universe is comprises of primordial black holes. And this basically shows, so in here on this horizontal axis is the mass of the halo, which contributes to the merger rate. So it's the minimal mass of the halo, which contributes to the merger rate. So So basically, this merger rate is integrated over all the halos convolved with some halo mass function. And this MC is the critical mass below which there is no contribution. So as we see, unlike for the binary black hole scenario, black hole neutron star, in the case of black hole neutron star, there is this flattening of this curve, so which means that very small halos do not contribute a lot to the merger rates. And also the overall merger rate is very small compared to expected merger rate. So the conclusion is that while binary black holes can be of primordial origin, black hole neutron star events cannot be interpreted as primordial black hole neutron star mergers. So that's a quick quick summary. So I'll stop here. I will thank you for your attention.
Okay, great. All right. So thanks, Valerie. So let's all unmute. I'd give him a round of applause for his great talk.